Tell me about the tall men.
They're these tall men in dark suits. They're collectors. You can't get away from them. They're like phantoms.
Have you heard of the Babylonian Brotherhood?
Not crazy. They set me up.
You have the amount to do, customer 152.
Tell me about the tall men.
How many
were there?
I've been telling your company from the beginning that I don't have it.
Oh, that is a problem.
This is Robert Stark. I'm here with Jonathan Holbrook. He's a film director. Jonathan, it's great talking to you.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
So, Jonathan, I discovered your work. I saw your film, Tall Men. I think it was on either Hulu or Netflix. I think Hulu.
Yeah, it was Hulu. We're not on Netflix.
So the story of your film, Tall Men, there's this man who's... He's mentally ill, and he lives by himself, and he gets this bizarre credit card, and there is these mysterious tall men who are following him around, and it coincides with him getting the credit card, but there are a lot of different angles to it. What originally gave you the inspiration to go with the theme with the credit card companies?
Well, in 2004, I had originally made the movie, and it was called Customer 152. I shot it years ago, and this is actually a remake, Tall Man. But the original idea came up when I knew I was working in a factory, and I had some coworkers that were bragging about claiming bankruptcy. And they were kind of working the system, like, oh, spend all the money on your credit cards, and then you can just claim bankruptcy. And I got kind of irritated with that, and so I that's what pretty much brought up the idea. But the original idea was kind of preachy, and it wasn't really two sided, and so. Originally after we were done with the film, I just wasn't really happy with it because I wasn't able to shoot it the way I wanted to, just with the resources that we had back then, the lack of resources. And so anyway, I wanted to remake it. And so I did, and the working title was still Customer 152, the remake, I guess. And, but I decided to add more meat to it.
It wasn't just more high budget. You did change the plot a bit.
I didn't change the plot too much, other than the fact that it just had a little bit. It was a little bit more. It just had a little bit more meat to it. It wasn't one sided, and I kind of. It kind of bounced back and forth. I wanted to make it more like a mystery as well. I left a lot of loose ends, so that way people can think. Is this really happening? And that's basically why I wanted to do the second one. Because the original one was just kind of, it was just basically just a small private project. But this one, I knew it had an okay story. And I think it had a lot of potential. And that's why I remade it.
Yeah, you play with the sense of perception of reality. The yeah. character, I guess, is diagnosed as a schizophrenic. But you mm-hmm. you play with one's perception of reality. Are you influenced by David Lynch?
Actually, there is a little bit of influence with most of my work regarding him. Yeah, he was the reason why I became a filmmaker. In 1987, I watched Blue Velvet. It was at the point I was 18 years old and. Trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. And I was an artist and I could write, I could do photography. And I just wasn't really sure what route to go. I used to draw And so after I saw Blue Velvet, I said, I think this is what I want to do. So I've been doing it ever since.
And also with the ending is very mysterious. I don't want, I guess I won't give away the whole ending.
Yeah.
But there's a sense, there is that kind of sense of confusion that you get in a film like, say, Mulholland Drive.
Throughout the whole, there's, you probably noticed that I left a lot of loopholes in it where you're kind of wondering, it kind of makes you think like, okay, did this really happen? Or I did it on purpose. And either you win or lose doing it that way. But, you know, a lot, I try to make it into a thinker, if that makes sense. But yeah, I left it. Yeah, I still kept it balancing with the reality and or is this real or is it not?
With the whole narrative with the credit card companies, is it, you're saying it was a critique of people who go into massive credit card debt, or is it a narrative that the credit card companies are exploitative, or both?
I'd say both. Yeah, in the original movie, Terrence, who's the main character, he's kind of struggling, like, should he sign up for a credit card again after he just got himself out of debt? And in the original movie, it was that basically the bad guy was the good guy, I guess, who was the credit card company. But I wanted to balance it out a little bit in the second one, where it can go either way.
So the tall men can symbolize a lot of different things. They could symbolize the credit card companies, but I noticed in the film there's a reference to lizard people. Is that a reference to the whole sort of David Icke conspiracy theory?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. And I didn't know anything about that theory until just recently, and it just kind of worked. And so I just kind of worked that in there with the Babylonian Brotherhood. And you can't take the lizard people literally with the especially with the story, but it was a good symbolism, and I thought it tied in with that.
What would you say overall that the tall men represent? That you never really show their faces; you just show their bodies.
Yeah. I kind of struggled with that. I was like, should I show their faces? Like, should we have, because you probably noticed that the cover, or the art, the poster art, it kind of misrepresents the tall man.
I think it shows them as faceless.
Oh yeah, on the cover art. They look kind of like Slenderman on the.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and that's not what we're going for at all. I wanted to be as practical as possible, and so I thought the best way was just to have them faceless, where you just see the silhouettes, or they're so tall. I also wanted to give the impression that they're so tall that they just kind of disappear into darkness up above. The symbolism with them, to be honest, it's a little simpler than that. I basically just wanted some creepy tall guys that were quiet. They were, like godless killing machines, I guess you can call them. And it's basically, I don't really think guys, they symbolize something, and the fact that they're just, they just have no feeling, and they just do what they're told by the powers to be.
And you also acted. You played one of the roles.
Yeah, I was one of the tall men. I'm six seven, 320 pounds. So, my cousins are bigger than me. They're 7 feet tall.
Oh, and your cousins were the other ones.
Yeah. Actually, one guy. There's one image where we're all standing in front of the curtain when Terrence wakes up in the chair, and one of my cousins weren't available that day, and so we had to use one. We had to use one of my PAs, and he's about. He just might be just under 6 feet tall, and so we had to get a couple of apple boxes and kind of fix the outfit a little bit so he looked a little bit broader in the shoulders and stuff.
How did you come up with the idea for the character of Terrence? He has the background. There's sort of his own mental illness, but then there's the whole backstory between him and how he murders his friend because she asked him to kill her.
Yeah. In the original story, in the 2004 version, I made him look a little crazier, where it was less sympathetic, and he just he had a mental illness where it kind of implies also it you didn't really see him kill the girl in the first one. Is basically you just see him standing over an inflatable swimming pool, and the little girl was a lot younger than him too, so it wasn't really a playmate. It was just a girl next door. So, but anyway, in the new one, I wanted to give him more of a love interest and more of a guilt throughout kind of like the mystery girl, because you see her throughout the movie. And you kind of wonder what's going on there until you see her dress, because she wears the same dress that she dies in. And so basically, I just wanted, like I said, I just wanted to add more meat to the film as opposed to the original one. And I wanted to be more of a mystery and kind of like. Because I honestly didn't really know how to end the film, unless it would be really trite, and I don't like try not to be trite in my films. So I that's basically why I wrote her in like that.
And then there was this. This is definitely a big spoiler, but I'll say it anyway. There's a scene where he finds out that he's being charged with the murders,
right?
And there's that scene at the police station. And you don't really know what happens, because it could be either way, because you're kind of playing on the back again to the theme is like, what is reality, what isn't?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, because I wanted to confuse the audience a little bit, thinking, you know, they've got it figured out, and then they kind of go, oh crap, and what is this, you know?
So. What do you think about the ending of the most of the finale of Twin Peaks?
Yeah, you know, I honestly don't know. I when I watched it, I was just a little. It left me hanging, and I kind of wonder if that's it. You know?
Yeah. He doesn't give. I mean, Lynch's signature style is he leaves some things open-ended, but I felt like in this one, he left way too much open-ended.
Yeah, he left way too much, and, I love Lynch's older stuff, but, you know, throughout the whole series, I felt like it was probably, people are going to hate me for this too, but I thought it was kind of grueling going through the first, 12 episodes. You know, with the Dougie thing, and it was also there's a lot of Eraserhead fans out there. You know, I've seen Eraserhead a couple of times and stuff, but Blue Velvet was his film, I think. That was the one that gave that vibe. But I felt like he had a little bit too much Eraserhead in the Twin Peaks, because the original Twin Peaks series, it was a little bit more tame, and I think that it worked better, if that makes sense.
In your film, Tall Men, where did you film most of the locations?
It was a house in Everett, Washington, and I just have friends that have businesses or houses, and they just let me use it. My friend Katrina, who owns the house that we, the main house that we shot in, she just handed the keys over to me, And she says, okay, well, I'm going to, you know, we shoot, all we did was we shoot on weekends. And so I would tell her, hey, we're going to come shoot at the house. And so she says, okay, well, I'll go ahead and go get a hotel somewhere. Or I'll just hang out upstairs or whatever, and you guys just go to town. So I was really lucky with that. And buddy of mine, Brett, when he owns Alexander Printing in downtown Everett, and that we used his basement with the freight for the freight elevator and for the work scene, the real dreary work scene.
Where did you film the jail scene?
The county jail, the county corrections center. I was in the right place at the right time, and I talked to the right person. The guy who was in charge of the one of the sergeants who was in charge of the count the corrections center. Well, I have a friend who's a detective, and he in the sheriff's department, and he asked around and stuff, and so he got me in touch with somebody. We had to go through several hoops to get to the right person, and then the right person asked what kind of camera I was using, and I think that's what did it. I just said, hey, we shoot with a Canon 5D, and I told them that, and the guy knew what the camera was, and he's a hobbyist or an enthusiast for video production and stuff, and so he knew what it was. So he goes, oh, this guy might be a little serious. He's not some stupid kid with a camera. And so that's what he told me himself as well when I saw him the day we were shooting. So I thought that was kind of interesting. I think it was in the right place, right time, and I had the right camera. It was really weird. But
did you film the whole scene of the torture scene?
The torture scene, it was in the living room in that house.
Did you use a lot of special effects?
We used some practical makeup and stuff, but we used no After Effects or anything like that, no CG or anything like that. There's a couple times we did for the grandmother's eyes, but you can't really tell. But it was mostly if there was a mistake, like in the background. You probably remember Detective Knotts, when he's checking the squeaks in the floor and he's rocking back and forth. In the background, you could see a whole bunch of crap on the table in the original footage, and we had that taken out. So, you know, it was a bunch of we had lunch, and then somebody left a bunch of food and drinks on the table. We just didn't notice, and until we were in post production, and so I had my effects guy wipe them out. And you can't even tell. And we also we used a real credit card, and it had my name on it and everything. We just spray painted it black and stuck a 152 on it. And I had the special effects guy kind of wipe out my name and put in a fake number. So,
how did you choose your casting decisions for the main character of Terrence as well as the other characters?
You know, I don't really go through an audition process. I don't like doing that because it's really time consuming. Plus, it's very uncomfortable for everybody, and especially if the actor's not doing a good job, and then you know you just kind of have to pretend, oh, great job. You know, it's like, it kind of sucks. So what I pretty much do is I ask actors to send me their acting reels. And I just watch what they've done in the past, and I just kind of I just try to picture them in that role, and then I call them in and just talk to them and stuff, and kind of, you know, make sure I can gel with the customer. I mean the actor, and if we get along and stuff, and we have this vibe going, I hire them on, basically. Now with Dan Crisafulli, who played Terrence, that was a different process. I was asking for people to send their headshots and reels and stuff like that. Well, it wasn't really a different process, it was the same one. But I was not successful in finding the right person for that part. And I just needed somebody to be kind of quirky, kind of, that can kind of, in the first movie, in the first version, the guy who played Terrence, he did a good job, I think, but he wasn't really an actor. It was more like an experimental film, you know, at that time. But he wasn't really an actor, and but he did a good job and everything, but it was too much of a cartoon character. So I had to explain that. I wanted to make it more more drama-like and more realistic, kind of, you know, with the reactions of the character and stuff, and not so cartoony. So finally Dan Crisafulli sent me his headshot, and once I saw his headshot, I said, "Oh my God, that's the guy!" You know, he's a good-looking guy, but he's kind of weird-looking at the same time. You know, that's kind of, so I that's the kind of guy I wanted, somebody who was appealing to the eyes somewhat, but can just look really goofy at the same time.
So yeah, it's basically meant to be likable, but a little bit off at the same time.
Exactly, that's what I wanted, and so he Dave Schechter is my co-producer, and my AD back then, all three of us were sitting in my office, and we were meeting with Dan. So anyway, Dan came in, and once he came in, we said, "Oh my God, I think this is the guy." Just by looking at him, he was real thin and he just had the posture and everything. Anyway, I sat down and gelled with him a little bit and talked to him about the character and everything. And then he started, he just flat out went into the acting, impersonating this character I wanted by my descriptions. And he pulled it off and I said, "Okay, you're in." So, for several months, almost 6 months, every weekend, we shot that film with him. My biggest concern was he's in probably 90% of the film. And so I needed to find a good actor that could carry the film because it's already a long film and I didn't want it to feel tedious and people just getting tired of Dan. So, and I personally feel like he did a really good job and, I think he pulled it off.
Yeah, I definitely pulled it off. And how did you select the other characters, like his co-workers?
I know them through the film community, and so a lot of them were my acting friends. And so, when you're with your friends at times and stuff. Well, I did a TV series that's on Amazon as well right now. It's called Still, and I worked with a lot of these people in Still
as an actor.
As actors, yeah. And so some of the characters I've worked with before and still, and so I kind of knew how they worked and everything. Like Kay Whitney, who played Lucy, she came on as the receptionist. It was a real small part and stuff, but she's really pretty, but she's got the quirky look, you know. So I immediately cast her for Lucy. I kind of wrote that part for her because in the original film, he doesn't have a girlfriend or a love interest, I guess you could say.
And you have an upcoming film. It's called Beloved Beast. When is that going to come out?
We're still in production. We're going to be done with it at the end of October. And then post-production should be done before March. So I'm thinking we're probably going to start pushing out to the festivals and start shopping it out around March or April.
Would you say, are most of the films that you do, are they mostly horror?
Lately they have been. Still, it's a science fiction horror. It's kind of a cross between Walking Dead and Twin Peaks. Then there was Tall Man. And then Beloved Beast is more like a horror. It's a horror. But right now, yes, I'm usually attracted to the dark stories. So I'm thinking about my next one's going to be a drama, a dark, twisted drama. Probably less makeup, special effects. because that's a bitch.
What is a Beloved Beast about? There's like a reference to a Rabbit King, and then you have the rabbit in Whiskers. Is there some reference to David Lynch's series about the rabbits?
Oh, no, it has nothing to do with that. What gave me the idea for Beloved Beast? I did Whiskers originally for a contest, and I just so happened to have a rabbit mask in my office, and it was one of those timed projects that you do, those contests like the 48-hour project, or this one was I can't remember what the name of it was, but you had 72 hours to make a film, and so we shot Whiskers in 72 hours, and I thought, after, you know, for a couple of years, I started thinking, I was like, God, that'd be kind of cool to do a feature with, you know, doing Whiskers. And then it just kind of transformed more into Beloved Beast, which is a completely different story. And I had that, the mask and Beloved Beast actually custom made. We had two of them made. Paper mache and stuff. When I was a kid, I was really into Watership Down, that animated movie.
Oh, yeah.
And so I talked to the artist who Chris Carroll, she's a great talent. She does great. She's our props person that she custom makes our props for us. And I'm kind of looking for I want a gentle face like a Watership Down rabbit. You know, I sent her some images from the movie and everything like that. And so, I don't know if you've seen the images of Harvey yet, but definitely looks like one of those Watership Down rabbits.
Are you talking about for Whiskers or Beloved Beast?
No, I'm sorry, Beloved Beast. Whiskers was just a rubber mask that you can get on Amazon.
So you're talking about the Rabbit King? Is that a central figure in Beloved Beast?
Yeah. What, in Beloved Beast, I guess I can tell you what it's about. It's about this little girl who she's in a car wreck with her parents, and her parents die in the wreck, and so she's got to go live with her just very dysfunctional aunt who wasn't very close, kind of the black sheep of the family. But and the aunts kind of agreed to take care of the kid just for the trust fund. So that being said, you know, she doesn't care for the kid too much or anything. She kind of does her own thing. So the kid's got to fend for herself, and she goes out in the woods and just goes and kind of plays like she's the Rabbit King. With the mask, her father, there's a flashback. It kind of foreshadows this mask. But she has this mask that her father wears when he reads this book called The Rabbit King to her, and so she, throughout the movie, she kind of she ties in the story with her actual life. If that makes sense. And anyway, so she goes out in the woods with the Rabbit King mask, and she puts it down, and she's distracted by some other incident. And she comes back and it's gone. And to make a long story, well, what happens also? There's so many sub stories in this movie. It's going to feel like I'm kind of jumping back and forth here. Meanwhile, Slough Town, there's an asylum, and then there's an escaped lunatic, and he's wandering around in the woods. So what happens is. She meets up with this lunatic in the woods, and he's the one who takes her mask. He kind of follows her around and stuff because she's wearing the rabbit mask, so he's very attracted to it. She puts it down. She goes off and does her thing. She comes back. She realizes it's gone, and so he's got it on. But to make a long story short, they befriend one another in the woods, and she brings him back home and hides him in the shed, and all hell breaks loose. Kind of like E.T.,
So yeah, E.T., Twin Peaks, a number of different things.
Yeah, exactly.
Is it going to be filmed in the Pacific Northwest?
Oh yeah. We're shooting in the same town, Everett. Actually, it's just down the street. The main house is just down the street from the house that we shot Tall Man in. Same neighborhood. They've got some really cool old houses from like 1901 and stuff, and so I like those old creepy houses.
Can you talk about the TV series still you've worked on? That's for Amazon.
Yeah.
So you were a writer on that series. That's horror and sci-fi.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, it's a it starts off where there's these sounds in the sky, and there's something that comes down on the people when the sounds come out. It sounds like an awful screech, and it's basically there's a microscopic shower of parasites that come down and attach to people's skin. I mean, you don't see it because it's microscopic. Plus, we're low budget, so it worked. You just kind of see people looking at their skin, feeling like there's something wrong with their bodies. And then they get infected, and when they get infected within 48 hours, they're kind of zombie-esque, but it's not a zombie show. They don't eat people or anything like that. They just infect people by touching them. And they actually stand still. They don't move. That's why it's called still. And the only time they move is when you look away from them and you look back at them, they've shifted to a different position, and usually it's closer to you. And it's kind of a mind trip. I did some research on electromagnetic storms and stuff like that, and solar flares and what happens. And they talk about there's also a switch in time somewhat. It gets kind of deep and weird. And I didn't understand too much, but I kind of threw it in there where the clocks are not working right and stuff. And with the mind trip thing, it's kind of like that's how they travel. It's kind of a time shift. But when you look away from them and you come back, they've moved. And it's kind of weird. It's kind of deep and weird, you know. And it's typical science fiction BS, actually.
And there's also a horror film coming out. It's a short one called Braceface. So you wrote this?
A filmmaking friend of mine up north for me. She helped me on Tall Men as a PA. And there's a film community up north that every year they have this thing called the Bleedingham Film Festival. And she wanted to do a short for that. Anyway, she approached me with the story concept, and she's not a writer, but she has ideas. And so I kind of just went off her idea and tweaked it a little bit and wrote the screenplay. And then we co-directed it together.
And in Beloved Beast, you also are acting in that. Which roles are you going to play?
I'm Harvey. Since I'm the 6'7" 230-pound guy, I can play Chewbacca, Darth Vader, you know, Predator. I could play all those guys. So I thought, hell, why not play Tall Men and Harvey? So,
is this your first speaking role since you didn't talk in Tall Men?
Harvey doesn't talk either.
Okay.
Because he has that mask on. So, and he's got the mind of a 10-year-old too, and so he's pretty much mentally disabled, and he's got hysterical strength. He's one of those characters.
Oh, so in Customer 152, which Tall Men is based on, you play one of the sergeants.
Yes.
I noticed within Tall Men, you have them in street clothes. Are they supposed to be plain clothes, or is it sort of to imply that they are fictitious because they're not really in uniforms?
Well, they do kind of have a uniform. It's that they're in business suits, and I kind of wanted to give that feeling like they're clones of Lurch
from Adam's Family. Yeah.
Yeah, I had the costume designer go to the thrift store and look for suits that are one size smaller than what we all wear, and so So yeah, it was basically, I just wanted to look, make it look like they all walked out of the crypt, came out of the crypt, and, you know, kind of like Lurch.
What are your thoughts on getting your work out there? How effective has Hulu been?
Well, I guess we can go back to Still real quick, because that was my first success. I had been pushing Still on all avenues, all social media avenues, including LinkedIn, and that's how there's a company called Proven Entertainment and their sales agents, and they picked us up. They made me an offer, well, saying that they can help me get it out there and stuff, and so they got it on Amazon Prime for us. And it's international as well. It's not just the USA. So it's kind of funny. They found us on LinkedIn of all places. I hardly ever use it except, yeah, it was nuts. So anyway, yeah, I got this email one morning from one of the founders of Proven Entertainment, and they said they'd be interested in taking on the project and see if we can get it out there. So, so it's been up for a couple of years on Amazon Prime now, and we're still making the same amount of money on it, so.
Oh, yeah, that was the other filmmaker whose film I discovered on Hulu, James Medaglia, if you've heard of him. He said the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, with Tall Man, there's a sales agent / distributor. They can have an interesting business model where they'll try to shop it out for you, and if they're not successful, then they'll just distribute it themselves. So I put it out to like 30 distributors or something and sent off the screener and stuff. And we had within 2 weeks we had six or seven offers, which blew me away. And so we looked at all the sample contracts and stuff, and we went with Ruthless. One of my peers that's also a filmmaker in Seattle, he got distributed through Ruthless. And so I called him and said, hey, you have the contact number to Ruthless? And he goes, sure. Because I've helped him out on other projects and stuff that he did. So he kind of did me a favor and gave me a phone number. And so anyway, Ruthless watched it, and they said, yeah, this is like something we could probably try to get shopped out and distributed and stuff. And it took about a year with all the paperwork and the music licensing and stuff. But it was also them shopping it out and getting people's attention. And Gravitas Ventures picked us up.
Is Chronicle Factory, is that your production company?
That's my production company, yeah. And Ruthless Studios is my agent, and Gravitas is the actual distributor.
We are getting close to the end of the show, but before I wrap things up, is there anything else you'd like to plug about Beloved Beast, and in case the audience is interested in finding a way to watch it when it comes out?
They can go on Facebook. We have a Facebook page. It's facebook.com/BelovedBeastMovie. And they can also go to BelovedBeastMovie.com, and that goes to the official site, and goes to the Chronicle Factory site. So if anybody wants to see other stuff that I've done, they can that way. And they can also go to for Tall Men, it's the same thing. They just go to TallMenMovie.com. And you could find the Facebook page on there and everything. So everything's linked into each other. So you can find everything that has to do with both of those films on their official pages, including the Facebook.
And you said that's going to be Beloved Beast is going to be released in October.
No. We're done in October in principal shooting. Yeah, we've been shooting since April. Every single weekend, nonstop. We've been taking a couple days off, but I've had a real loyal crew. It's awesome. But anyway, we'll be done at the end of October, and then we'll go into post production, and we should be done with it. I do the editing myself as well, so I could just bust through it through the holidays.
Jonathan Holbrook, it's been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Okay, great. I appreciate it. Thanks, Robert.